Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au.
I am so excited to tell you that InvestSmart and Intelligent Investor are long-term sponsors of this podcast. And here's something I want to tell you about. The Intelligent Investor Select Value Fund is a unique mix of global leaders and homegrown small caps poised for long-term growth. The portfolio manager is Nathan Bell, a talented investor you have heard on the RAS network many times. The Select Value Fund is designed for investors seeking international diversification and Aussie companies with superior financial metrics. You can invest today at intelligentinvestor.com.au. That's intelligentinvestor.com.au.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes. Drew Meredith, welcome to this episode of the Australian Investors Podcast.
Thank you.
Today we're talking about seven companies. Why seven and not 10? Well, because we didn't coordinate before we hit record, and we both ended up covering a few of the same companies. So we're going to cover CSL, Seek, Vicinity, Redbubble, Challenger, BHP. I've got Car Sales, and I've got, is that it? Is that on my list? I think that's all on my list. Yeah, because I did CSL, Redbubble, and Seek as well.
So maybe a quick comment on Brambles as well.
Quick comment on Brambles. There you are. So 7.5 companies today is what we're covering. Rather than kind of dwell on it, it's been a pretty volatile week. We've seen a kind of mixed bag of results. Companies, you know, pretty typical for reporting season, falling 5, 10% either side. Redbubble being the exception to that, falling over 30% upon release of its results. So a lot of eyes looking at that one there. Mate, why don't we start with the most popular company amongst this list, which is CSL, given its sheer size. Maybe if you share what you thought, and then I'll share what I thought about the company's result.
Yeah, I mean, it was sold down, I think, 2 or 3%. The market managed to overcome, I think, second biggest company on the ASX. So, everything it does drives the market. Sold down after profit fell 5% to $2.3 billion US. Mm-hmm. It was interesting that management were pretty quick to indicate that that was actually the second biggest profit in the history of CSL since it was floated in 1992, I think. So, kind of impressive in that regard. I think the issues for this year were kind of well appreciated. That's why the share price didn't move all that much. And that was, so CSL does blood treatments, immunology, and in order to do blood treatments, you need to acquire blood and, yep, and pay for blood. So that's blood donors all over the US, Australia. Part of it, I know there were issues on around the Mexican border where they were struggling to get donations. And that's very much a leading 12 months ahead. So you need blood before you can use that and treat and you know, blend that to make treatment. So 12 months ago, they were struggling for volumes, and now they've had a surge in volume, something like 24% in 2022, which bodes well for next year. And that's what management said, I think.
Would you consider CSL a growth stock?
Yes.
You would?
Yes.
Interesting. Well, how do you define growth stock?
Well, it's returning to growth. One, I mean, most people look at the PE and say it's on a high PE compared to the market.
I think it's like 41 times or something.
And I still probably think it's cheap.
Bold. Here we go.
I mean, a big part of the, CSL is a company that's always been expensive.
It's always been expensive.
We're trying to manage portfolios, and the hardest stock to buy, everyone's held it at some stage, and there was a point last year where anyone who bought CSL ever was in a profit. I think there's only a small portion of people that aren't in a profit on CSL at the moment. We must be about 280, 290 today. Mm-hmm. I think whilst revenue only grew 2.9% and profit fell, you're looking at a company that invests 11% of revenue every year into R&D, and that on its own should set it up to being a growth stock versus a income or a value stock.
Yeah, I think in the context of Australia, it's definitely like in terms of blue chips, it's definitely on the growth year end. How about though, if you compared it to say one of the big, I'm just trying to get up the data and ticker, one of the like US tech stocks that might also invest 15%.
They trade on much lower PEs too, don't they?
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. So, because CSL, you know, is an international business as well. So that's like, so Google's, Alphabet's price to earnings ratio is 22. And I think it invests about 15% back in R&D. But interestingly, right, so I'm just looking at the normalized earnings per share as for the PE ratio, trailing. It looks like it averaged over 40 times earnings during COVID, all the way back to, say, the beginning of late 2019.
Yeah.
And recently, on a normalized basis, it's more like 36 times earnings. But if we go for the 2010s period, it was trading anywhere between 20 and 30 times all the time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, always at the higher end, because the ASX's average is around about 15 or 16.
And PE is something that penalizes companies that are doing R&D as well, because your earnings are cut by the R&D that you're making. So if you, the more you invest into yourself, you kind of penalize on a valuation basis. So if there's a few reports that have backed that out and you know found it never actually trades that expensively. Mm. And if they grow at 9% like they're predicting next year, well, that's going to be significantly better than most parts. I think the ASX either is expected to shrink over the next 12 months or potentially grow at 2 to 3%, so three times system would be good.
So just to throw some figures out, $2.22 in dividends, a $1.18 final dividend, which is the same as last year. It's 10% franked, but it's up if you adjust for currency. So they were quick to point that out.
Equal to the original purchase price of CSL shares.
Is that what it was?
I think it's $2 a share.
Oh right, okay, wow. When did it IPO? It was like early 90s?
1992.
Yeah. So revenue up 2%, profit down 5%. Interestingly, over the past 5 years, the company's CAGR'd its top line, so compound annual growth rate, meaning growth on growth every year of 11%. In that time, we've had some acquisitions. Now, see, here's my problem with CSL.
is 11% CAGR not growth?
It is good growth.
Yeah.
However, that's just the top line. We've also got to consider that in that time, the company's actually taken on a bit of debt. So it's kept its dividend, but it's taken on a bit of debt and it's made more acquisitions than it have previously necessarily, like bigger acquisitions. Like the most recent one, I can't remember the exact price. It was $6.5 billion is what they ended up paying.
V4. Yeah. V4.
Yeah. Swiss company. Yeah.
Yeah.
Moves it into a kind of an adjacency, which CSL want to go in as part of their 2030 strategy. But I don't know, more acquisitions, can it maintain that? Like, I guess my question is like, what's a $150 billion company for round figures? I don't have it in front of me. Can it maintain that growth and therefore demand the same type of PE ratio, or should it be coming down now? I don't know, that's my question. Maybe something we can throw out there, another answer.
I think R&D is going to be more important than the acquisition. When they talked about that acquisition and saying that the company they bought wasn't as good at commercializing product as CSL. So it's not just the you know, the revenue and the potential of that business, but actually the drugs and the R&D that they've been working on. Yeah. And how you scale that. So you look at the flu vaccine business, which was a bad acquisition at the time. It took 3 or 4 years to stomach or process. And that grew 15% over the last, you know, 12 months. And obviously the market for flu vaccines has never been more important, never been more relevant. So I think it's always going to gobble things up naturally. And the companies like this, I mean, the best quote from, I think, the CEO was, we can't progress a sustainable growth strategy without investment in R&D. If we're not innovating, we're managing our exit from the business. So it's kind of refreshing in Australia, where everyone basically pays out dividends and the company is just committed completely to growth.
Yeah, that's fair. So I got asked this last night on Self-Wealth. Self-Wealth is a sponsor of the show. Fantastic to have them. So last night I got asked, someone said to me, they're buying BHP for dividends and CSL for growth. And I was like, I'd probably buy something else for growth, to be honest, like rather than just straight up CSL. Because I don't know, I just feel like there's other companies that can compound faster if growth is the key thing. But that said, I totally take your point. For a blue chip company, super wide moat, compounding, you know, the top line at 10 or 11%, if you can get some operating leverage in there too. Healthcare isn't going away. Blood plasma donations, yeah, COVID impacted it, but that's not going away. So Fair points. And snake bites, they aren't going away. People are still walking through the bush and they need their anti-venom.
You're not going to get 30% jumps like a car sales or something like that. It's probably wary on CSL.
Yeah.
And it's also hit more by macro events as well. So,
yep.
Majority of their income comes from US dollar earnings. So, there's a currency conversion back to Australia. And then if there's a, you know, bond yield, increase in the bond yield, will CSL is generally sold off on a macro view.
Mm. The company did end the year with a bucket load of cash on its balance sheet. If you're wondering how that got there, that's from the capital raising, and it's just the timing difference. So the company does have a bit of debt. But yeah, a lot of that, I think it was like $11 billion from memory, was shown on the balance sheet. But yeah, $10.4 billion of cash, but that was to pay for the acquisition that then settled in August. So, well, most of it did anyway. So, what would you, if you were grading CSL's result, what would you give it? Like A, B, C, D, fail?
Pass. What's pass? D. D to C.
D to C. Yeah. Okay. Because it was a pretty tough year.
Yeah.
Lapping COVID and what have you. So, okay. Yeah. Good. I'd probably give it, yeah, like a C plus. So I think it's pretty good. And I think, you know, you and I doing this one podcast, we're not going to convince someone that's held the stock for 10 or 20 years to go and sell because we're worried about a little bit less growth. Like you said before, compounding, if you've held it for a very long time, those dividends are very, very juicy. So,
definitely.
Why not? Interesting fact about COVID, because I started giving blood for the first time like regularly during COVID through the Red Cross. And
I faint every time I give blood. So, really? It's been a struggle for me.
Well, okay, I probably wouldn't do it then. But yeah, so because during lockdowns here in Victoria, it was very hard to get out, right? So when I was in there, the nurses would tell me that they'd have regulars that were coming in during COVID because blood plasma you can give more frequently than actual bloods. And they were saying they'd get a lot of young ladies come in to give blood and they would use it as an occasion to catch up with their friends because they could have coffee and the cookies and stuff after the donation because they couldn't meet up any other way.
So is that why you were going there as well?
That's why I was going there, yeah.
The cookies or the young ladies?
So yeah. Young ladies, yeah. It's a chance to meet young ladies. No, but it's seriously, like it was a great initiative. And because I was worried. The reason that I gave blood was because I thought, well, no one's going to be going.
Yeah.
I better do something. I'm just sitting there. But they said, no, it's the opposite, actually. We've been inundated. So.
And we don't pay in Australia either, do we?
No.
You just get kind.
Biscuits.
Yeah,
good biscuits, though. And you get some chocolate milk
party
if you want.
Pies sometimes.
Go and do it. Great. It's a great thing to do. So that's a CSL, good result. A big Australian, which is BHP, good result from BHP. In fact, probably some people would say tremendous. And the reason why I say that is they paid a humongous dividend. Dividends up 8%. This is full year dividends up 8% to $3.25 a share, equivalent to $4.72. Just based on the current share price, that's a dividend yield of 11% fully franked. So maybe like 14% after franking credits. They also gave the distribution of the Woodside when they sold their oil and gas across the Woodside group.
Yep.
Interestingly, again, last night when I was on the live show, I asked some people, you know, have you invested in the company, blah, 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 blah. Some people got in the teens with BHP a few years ago and some people invested in the early 20s. Or the low 20s, I should say. And so their dividend yield was equivalent to 25% of their cost base. And that's only a few years down the track. So what a reversal commodities have had and massive profits and massive dividends from the likes of BHP and Rio. I don't know if you looked at the result, but...
I think I'm old enough to remember the progressive dividend policy.
Oh, yeah. And that got cut years ago.
That was, I think, when the share price fell into the teens. So that was the idea. I think they were trying to be a dividend aristocrat, which was... Every year, the dividend was going to increase, even if it was at a 50% payout. So, to see it recover and go beyond that kind of talks to how well the company's been managed and also the support of commodity prices this year.
Yeah. They obviously, for those of you that don't follow the stock market that closely, BHP made a pitch for Oz Minerals, who shot it down pretty quickly. That was a copper play. So, BHP offloaded its oil and gas to try and simplify its business. And for the most part, it's been a very strong kind of 5 years for BHP. I remember Scott Phillips, when I was at the Motley Fool, said that if he was ever going to buy BHP, now is the time. And I remember that because he's the type of guy that wouldn't ever invest in that type of thing. And I just think, yeah, that was a pretty good call from him. The companies, you know, are continuing. So, they've got the continuing results and discontinued operations, which have all been restated fine. But profit from continuing operations up 34% to $29 billion. continuing EBITDA up 16% to $41 billion, revenue up 14% to $65 billion if you take total revenue of 71.5. So, yeah, pretty impressive business. Throughout all of this, they've also managed to reduce their net debt to $333 million, which is pretty much, I mean, that's net of cash, but that's pretty much nothing for a company of BHP's size. Enters 2023, quote, in great shape strategically, operationally, and financially, end quote. So,
yeah. How much earnings came from iron ore?
I don't know exactly. I don't have the segment report right in front of me, but I do have the volumes in front of me. And so volumes for iron ore were flat year over year. Copper was down 4%. Coal was down 9%. Energy coal down 4%. And nickel down 14%. So volumes mostly flat, but it was that expansion in price that we saw from commodities over the last year. It was probably a great time. You know, I think we'll look back in 1 or 2 years and say, what a great time it was to offload the oil and gas business.
Yeah.
They've been looking at trying to do things with that for a while. And so, you know, prices were high, as we know, for energy. So a good time to offload that. Simpler business. I probably still prefer it as an exposure to resources than Rio, just because Rio is very iron ore heavy.
Yeah.
At least BHP has quite a few other things in the irons in the fire. One of those things being the potash, the Jansen project, which is a massive Canadian potash project used in fertilizer.
Yeah, and they're kind of positioning themselves as this future minerals company, even though majority still comes from iron ore and they sell coal.
Yeah.
But they're definitely, the copper move is all about getting involved in the battery supply chain. And the one thing you always know with BHP, if they ever do the opposite, sell them straight away, is that they'll only buy the highest quality and lowest cost producing assets.
And they can do it because they're so big and diversified, cashed up.
It's a license to print money, essentially.
Yep. As long as they, you know, make good with the kind of the communities and the governments that wherever they're operating, which they normally do pretty well, you can just print money, dig stuff out of the ground, annuity-like revenue. And then when prices falter, you can buy the stock and they'll typically buy another mine that's already been built and paid for by someone else's pocket. So,
and have the infrastructure to get it all to market. I think something there, your iron ore cost is something like $15, $20 a ton.
Yeah.
And the price is obviously over
$100.
So you can imagine. $100. Doesn't matter what the price is, they'll always pump out cash flow, but I'd always be wary of that 11% yield.
It's a yield trap. Just full disclosure, it's a yield trap because forecast dividends are expected to come down considerably over the next 2 years, whether or not that analysts are correct. But so. Well done. Thank you for picking me up on that. Definite yield trap. Beware. You can get exposure to BHP, CSL, and all the others by buying the index, just so you know. If you want to deflect some of that kind of yield trap bias, you can buy the VHY ETF, which is a dividend ETF we've talked about on the show. Because you still get 10% or more to BHP as part of that because it's so massive. Yeah. It's a huge part of the index. So, I think BHP, in terms of scores, I would give it it's a good result. So, like an A. Just expect some softness going forward. Maybe we can do another company that we overlap on before we get to Vicinity. Why don't we talk about Seek, mate? Seek, the Australian jobs portal website, kind of expanding throughout Asia, Latin America. Tell us a little bit about it.
They were pretty aggressive. So we use LinkedIn quite a lot. And I was reading through the announcement last night and they talked a lot about the competition with LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And they were very clear to say that, you know, we only do jobs at Seek. We don't use your data and sell your data and advertise to you and do all kinds of other things like LinkedIn. So that was kind of a very interesting message I took away from the annual report.
Do you think LinkedIn's got better or worse since Microsoft bought them out?
I think it's got better. Definitely better integration, better usage, the use of that data. I mean, most of these tech companies have become advertising platforms, essentially. So
they all end up in advertisers, don't we, at the end of the day?
Exactly. Yeah, tracking you everywhere on the internet. But it is definitely very useful and a great source of news. You know, professionals probably moved away from the likes of Facebook, which is struggling at the moment, towards things like LinkedIn, where you can get a great deal of relevant news now too. Mm. But Seek, so we... For backstory, we bought this in the worst of the pandemic
and then
probably sold it a bit early. So I think we doubled our money or so for clients on the investment and then sold it a bit early when we thought valuation getting a bit too far. Didn't predict how tight the labor market would be and how good that would be for Seek.
Yep.
But with the tech sell-off, we're probably back where we sold it. So we're not as comfortable at the moment. That was a great result though. Was it revenue was up 46%, profit up, 150%. So that tells you that they've got operating leverage.
Yep.
And they're expecting another 10% growth next year. A lot of the headline, or most importantly, the dividend was up 10%, which it's kind of they split their company about 2 years ago into the Seek Growth. So that's the venture capital investments that's run by I think it's Andrew Bassett. It's Andrew, isn't it? Not Paul.
Yeah, I always get confused. Yeah. I should know off the top of my head, but I always get confused.
And then the ex-CBA CEO, Ian Narev, runs the Seek business in a t-shirt, if you notice that in the photos.
Yeah, right. Okay, I haven't checked that out.
It's a bit different to the combat days. Yeah. Like us.
One of us. This is me overdressed
in
a shirt. Full disclosure, I wear a hoodie to the office.
It was, I think the interesting story there was they split it into two businesses, and they're kind of like CSL, where they're investing for the future and trying to back the new Seeks in different parts of the world.
Which they've done a good job at, because one of the assets, I'm just going to throw this out there, Square Peg Capital, the VC, which one of the bigger VC names here in Australia.
Definitely.
Yeah, so they've got pedigree for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where a lot of the attention was in the media, was this idea that they're VC portfolio was technically worth $2.5 billion, but they actually devalued it by a quarter or so on concerns. They said significant valuation declines, and there was a disconnect between private and public valuations. And if you've been reading the newspapers, there's a lot of talk about this with industry super funds, institutional investors, Canva is in particular in the middle of it at the moment. So that was interesting that they cut that by 20%. And that was probably that's an impact on your statutory profit, but not on your
actual cash flow.
Exactly. It was super impressive, I thought.
Yeah, I think it's a tremendous result. Just circling back to that public v private, I saw some comments via a chief investment officer in industry super fund, CIO, basically saying no one cares about unlisted assets. No one cares. Our members don't care if we report it or not. Anyway.
But I'll always say there, but that means if you redeem before they revalue something down, well, you've got greater value than the person. You can go buy it back.
That's it. Wait for it to fall.
There's an arbitrage.
Swap out. I think we were saying that during COVID. Have you seen, I'm just going to turn this to you, and this is not good podcasting, but I'm just going to show you the chart of job vacancies. Have you seen that? It's insane. So the number of job vacancies in Australia at not just a record, but like pre-COVID, this would have been like 2.5 times the record of job vacancies in Australia right now.
Yeah.
And I'm hearing this everywhere, and everyone that I speak to, people saying, we can't find anyone. We've had to shut down the shop. Like, there's a cafe that I used to go to in Hawthorne. There's a big sign on the window that says, because I have a couple of cafes, and it says, we are not open because we do not have enough staff. Please go to our other cafe.
I was in Noosa last week, and there was the same problem up there. So they wouldn't open on some nights because they couldn't get enough staff for it.
Yeah, I was telling this story last night. I was at the Dorovich, the pathology, and there's three in my area. And I was talking to the ladies in there. I'm like, yeah, no, the other two just
you most days of the week don't open. Talking to ladies at healthcare.
What can I say? It's the best place to go. But I was chatting to them, and they were saying, the other clinics for the last week have had like 5 days where they just won't open because they just can't get people.
Yeah.
So they end up just being inundated in their clinic. But anyway, job vacancy is at record highs. So you would expect Seek to perform well.
They had record job ads in March, they said.
Yeah, right. Okay. In March, right. So that's not too long ago at all. Obviously, the big concern, because Seek shares are down, the big concern amongst investors is how bad does it get from here?
Yeah.
Like, what happens in 2023? Now, their guidance, I thought it was pretty robust, but there was some criticism thrown out. Like, their guidance is growth. Excluding some significant items, their guidance is for growth. So I thought it was decent. I didn't think there was anything bad about the outlook. What did you make of it?
The quote was, we have assumed a low risk of job market volatility from monetary policy, geopolitical change, and the pandemic. And that's a lot of assumptions.
Yeah, it is.
That everything will be fine. If this assumption changes, revenue could fall below guidance. So I think they're assuming Goldilocks, and that's probably what the market didn't like.
Yeah. True.
I mean, pretty opinionated on the jobs position, and you look overseas, the US has only just got to the same amount of people employed as there were before the pandemic. So unemployment rates halved, but there's less people working, and you can see that in Australia. Unemployment's at near an all-time low, but there's about the same people working as there were in 2019. So a big part of that's, I think, immigration and overseas workers no longer coming into the country, at least at the moment. Mm. How else do you have the same amount of job vacancies as unemployed? There's a mismatch in skills.
Good point. Yeah, good point.
That was a bit too macro, probably, though.
No. You're digging into the data. I like it. I'm not across it as well as you are. But that makes sense. And that would probably be the rhetoric from everywhere, right? Like, even jobs, you know, in transport and things like that, which are, like, for the most part, blue-collar jobs, pay really well, but blue-collar jobs, oftentimes they can be fulfilled. Like, I was in a region, Wangaratta, not long ago, which I know you know well. And the transport sector up there is really hustle and bustle because it's on the border between Vic and New South Wales. And they can't get, you know, they're saying all the people that can drive a truck are going to drive trucks, which means that people that were driving buses aren't driving buses anymore.
Because you get paid more driving a truck.
And some of the people that were doing that are now working on farms because there's no one on the farms doing, you know, the backpackers' jobs and they're getting paid well. So it's like they're pulling from other industries.
Yeah.
And that's where we see this big shift and it's on the margin. And so I guess what the implications for that are, maybe it turns around, it reverses pretty quick, maybe.
And we've always relied on immigration. So while borders are open, people aren't flooding in like they have in previous years or for the last 20 years. Mm. I think if that reverses, well, then you quickly see, you know, lower cost workers once again going into bars, going into cafes, going into restaurants, and then that will obviously flow it back into other sectors, you'd think, at some point.
Shout out to Beneath Driver Lane here in Victoria, in Melbourne CBD. Very good bar if you can get in. It's pretty exclusive this time of year, but it's a good bar if you want a whiskey or a rum or whatever takes your fancy.
Disclose my personal stake in business.
No, it's a great spot, so get down there. Okay, so we've done CSL, we've done BHP, Seek, good result. The outlook is the thing that people are concerned about, which is fair enough. One result I haven't looked at all, mate, which is Vicinity Centres. Can you just tell us what it does and what the result was?
I think the easy way to summarise it is that it owns Chadstone and then a series of, I think it's the Emporium Arcade in Melbourne and a series of major shopping centres and then some regional shopping centres as well.
Chadstone being the biggest shopping centre in Victoria, the fashion capital, if you like. They've got their own bus line that goes from the CBD straight to, nodding, straight to Chadstone. So, big hub for everything and there's a hotel and stuff there now too.
Yeah, and it was, you'd say on the headline, it was a great result. Profit was up 5 times. It went from a loss last year to a profit of $1.2 billion. Mm-hmm. They said a 500% gain in profit. I'm not sure if you can call when it goes from a loss to a gain, a 500%.
I always love that. The negatives, just spin it around.
Jumps it up. Essentially, you're buying a company that the funds from operation is the most important thing. That's where your rental payments are coming in. Mm-hmm. That was up 7%. They pay out 95% of that as distributions. And then they create value or make money either by changing the rental mix, increasing rent. So some see it as an inflation hedge where your rent goes up at a retail store. Sometimes they have links to the profitability of, say, a Woolworths or a Wesfarmers, and their rent goes up when that goes up. One of the big changes has been the valuation of their property. So, you know, during the pandemic, valuations went down, traffic went down, cash receipts went down. They were quite strong, I think, in the media. I think it was with Solomon, maybe Premier Investments or one of those groups. They were very strong in holding their position and not renegotiating too many leases and kind of seeing through it all. And the result was that over the 12 months, their net tangible asset value, so the value of the properties they own, went up 10% to $2.36. Mm. And I think that's about a 10 to 15% discount to the current share price? No, it should be the opposite.
Share price is $2.03, basically.
Yeah, so you're buying it at 10 to 15%. You're buying the assets 10 to 15% cheaper than what they're currently valued at.
Okay.
And, I mean, all the trends in there were positive. They haven't got a whole lot of gearing. They managed to negotiate their way through the pandemic reasonably well. And one of the interesting takeaways you might agree with if you're a shopaholic and always out and about.
It was healthcare, maybe.
The less visitation at malls or shopping centres, as we call them, is lower than it was pre-pandemic, but people are spending more money and they're calling it like this more engaged or committed or I can't remember exactly what the word was, shopper, where you're going for a reason and you're spending everything at that time rather than going consistently. So good for healthy retailers are good for healthy shopping centers.
Well, I know there's a Tesla store in Chadstone. So if you're buying Tesla, it's going to increase your basket size a little bit.
I'm trying to.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice? What do you make of interest rates going up though for REITs and property?
They're actually coming down already. That's why all the property trusts have done well in the last 6 weeks.
As in, like, that's why they're like, because the revaluation of those fixed rates are dropping.
I think one thing, there's a few things to consider that. Yeah, generally a higher bond yield should eventually equate to a higher cap rate, and a cap rate is what the key tool you use to determine the valuation of property. So one thing is always understanding how the cap rates. What cap rate levels are with these companies. Are they overly aggressive? You know, I think most of the properties in this portfolio are valued at about 5.25% yield. So they didn't get down to the 1.5%, 2% that industrial properties were trading at. So always understanding and where that sits compared to the market, which they're usually pretty good at sharing, how aggressively they're pricing their properties. Naturally, you'd think there'd be some level of reduction in value as bond yields. But it requires people to sell, essentially. Mm. And if you're holding high quality landmark assets, you're not having vacancies. Anyone that leaves is going to be quickly taken over. You're not discounting. Yeah. So that's the difference between this and a kind of sub-regional or lesser quality shopping center strategy. I think it's a risk, probably more on the gearing side. So how much of your interest rate risk have you hedged out? They've only got 25% gearing, which is pretty low for a property trust. So making sure that if interest rates did go back to 7%, you're not going to lose a massive amount of your profit, which they've been pretty good at.
Just on the Bloomberg government bonds here, 10-year yield is down 7 basis points over the past month. So that's, hinting. And I've
said that 3.1, 3.2?
3.33. I spoke to Chris Bates, who's a mortgage broker on the show recently, and he actually said Macquarie and CBA actually dropped their fixed rates on mortgages recently. So that we're starting to see that flow through to consumers as well.
This is what people don't really look at. You'll hear in the newspaper that the market is predicting interest rates to get to 7%, and that's because the 10-year bond yield went from 0.5 to 4% in about 3 months earlier this year. But it's since fallen from 4 back to 3.3, and the prediction isn't a set prediction like it sounds like when you read the media. It's actually a constant review of what's happening in the market. So you'd say and our view is that the expectations of interest rate hikes that were priced into the market were excessive, and it's slowly coming back to normal.
Yeah. You still get your
my interest rate on my mortgage is still going up.
Yeah, that could still happen if the RBA does increase interest rates, that could still happen. But it's the forward yields that we're looking at here. Like, what is the market pricing in the future, basically? Okay, so overall, then, sounds like a pretty good result.
Yeah, we were pretty happy with it. This is a part of our model as well. So probably a B.
Yeah, a B. Cool. What, when you say it's part of the model, so do you have a few of these in there, or is this just one exposure?
We generally have unlisted. But then saw this similar in the back end of the pandemic. So around the time the vaccine was announced, we had a few opportunities, kind of recovery opportunities, and we bought it back then.
Okay. Cool.
As a play on the reopening.
Yeah, I like it. Okay, so that's Vicinity. I'll do one that maybe I just will do solo because I don't think you've looked at the company, which is carsales.com. Really strong result. So, for those of you that don't trade in used cars are actually going up, which is for the first time that I can remember. Used cars, if you have a used car, you could probably get more for it than you paid for it. And so what that means is it's a really good market for car sales, which is Australia's dominant car portal. Whether you're selling new or used, it's actually still the dominant portal. The competition in the space, at least here in Australia and New Zealand markets, is pretty weak. You've got Facebook Marketplace and you've got Gumtree that do free ads. And those are fantastic for selling items, whether it's household items. But in terms of which companies actually target vehicles, there aren't that many. And no one at scale like car sales. So like Seek, these two companies kind of grew up beside each other, one in HR and one in automotive. And car sales over time has just done basically the same thing that Seek's done, used its core operations to pay dividends, to continue to invest and grow, and then expand outside of its core competency over time into adjacencies. Done a really good job of that. Most recently, however, it's put its chips down for a company called Trader Interactive, which does RVs and power sports vehicles and the like over in the United States. So it's a massive step for the business. About 18 months ago, I don't have the exact figures in front of me, about 18 months ago, Car Sales made a bid for Trader Interactive and bought 49% of the company. And since then, it's gained more conviction in the business and then had to stump up an additional $1.2 billion Australian, I believe. And that will give it the full 100% control. What I like about this deal is that they've gone into the US market in a way that is not the same as what, like they haven't just gone, okay, we're going to do Car Sales USA.
Yeah.
Because that would be hugely competitive. Instead, they've gone, well, the RV market is growing and power sports is growing. And we are really good at automotive and we've done really good at what they call yields, which is just price increases. It's REA speak for price increases. they're saying yields are up. And so basically they've said, well, we'll take our know-how, our engineering, and we'll apply that to this market. It's a way to get in. But what I like about it is they didn't just go, we're just going to launch straight over there. They went and bought a company and they bought a part of it. And then they thought, okay, this is working. We've got good visibility. Now we'll buy the whole thing. Some of the things that are really interesting about Car Sales, if you haven't been on there in a while, some of the things that they do recently is move into what it's called instant offer, where if you've got a used car, you want to sell it, you don't want to go through the rigmarole of trying to find a buyer and have people kick your tires and everything. They'll make you an offer on your vehicle. There's a few, obviously, there's an asterisk around that or two, but basically they buy your car from you. And this is, I don't know if you are across this company, but in the US, Zillow. Does this with property.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
did this.
Property. Yeah. They've started to unwind that. So, basically, what these big digital platforms have said is, you know, we're making so much money from these ads. People can pay $50 and get their car listed, or a real estate agent can pay REA Group, whatever. But now they've gone, well, this is a big transaction. We could make so much more money. And we've got the data to back up algorithms that could buy these assets and sell them and move into the physical away from just pure digital. And that's what most of them are trying to do.
I think it's better suited to cars than it is to property, like Zillow was doing, given the smaller ticket size and probably more granular, like a Honda from 1992 is similar to Honda from 1992, but you know, Edwardian house in Fairfield is not that similar to the next Edwardian house in Fairfield.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot more data on cars as well, right?
Yeah.
So they've tried to do that. In terms of like results, all very strong. Revenue up 36% on a look-through basis. EBITDA up 25%. NPAT up 27%. Reported basis, those figures are revenue 19%, EBITDA 12%, and NPAT 23%. They've got a lot of equity accounted style things where they own bits of this and bits of that. But for the most part, the core business is firing on all cylinders. I did not mean that pun, but there you have it.
Is there a risk that the obviously used cars are doing well? Do they also do
dealer?
Yeah. So is there a risk that
that's
been dragging? But
so what's been happening, which is interesting on the call, because the analysts were quite upbeat, I would say, but they were, and the Car Sales management team of like they're very good. So you know they have about 10 of them on the call. This division head, that person from there. So you can ask whoever any question, and it's very good how they allow questions to this person that's based in South Korea.
Yeah.
Whereas other companies, it's like just a CFO, just the CEO answering questions. And then I find it becomes very scripted and very like, this is like we're guarding our secrets. But with these guys, it's very much like, we'll answer the question. And so, one of the analysts which said pointed out that, you know, well, what happens if, you know, the forward estimates, like things get a bit tougher, we're not going to see this, you know, Goldilocks kind of period for private cars. And so, what's happening at the moment is used cars are getting like they're just flying off the shelf, so to speak. And so, what's happening is people are going to dealers and saying, hey, do you want to buy this? And the dealers are just lowballing them because they know that like the people want to sell, but they know that they're going to move it on. They've got enough demand. They don't have to, they're just going, yeah, whatever, we'll give this. And then people are turning to private sales. But as things get tougher, the dealers might become more active and need to be do more advertising, might need to be on Car Sales more regularly to get their sales happening.
Yep.
So it kind of has this counter-cyclical element to it where, and even we could apply that to private sellers as well. If you're not selling your car as well next year, what are you going to do? It's not selling on Gumtree. It's not selling on Facebook. The deal is like, so-so. Well, you go straight back onto car sales and you pay for the premium ad.
Yeah.
So it's got those counter-cyclical elements where Seek probably doesn't have that as well.
Yeah.
As well, it's got the optionality in Korea, Latin America, and now the USA. So not to be too bullish on the company, but it was a good result. Dividends were good. Profit was good. Pretty strong outlook. Maybe that there's a risk there that it's not a Goldilocks period next year. But I think for the most part, good result.
It looked great to me. I'm trying to buy a car at the moment and just given up.
Honestly, yeah.
For 2023, I think.
Yeah. So I gave up, to be honest, as well. I was looking for a Subaru online and everything was so expensive, like $5,000 or $10,000 more than what you'd think that they would go for.
Yeah.
And ended up buying one down the road. The guy just put a sign out. He's like, I'm getting rid of this. I'm like, okay, I'll take it.
Should have been on car sales.
Yeah, I reckon if he was on car sales, he would have sold it for $2,000 more.
Yeah.
But he was looking for a quick sale and I was happening to live on the street. So that works for me. So yeah, I mean, yeah, good outlook. Interesting move into the US, something to watch closely. Australian companies don't always have the best track record of moving into the US. So, yeah, it'll be a good period to watch the business going forward. There's still some weakness around with COVID, by the way, too, in places like Mexico. So, it's not all roses for the business, but a good result. So, we've done a few names now, mate. What's next?
I got Challenger. So, my theme of fund managers.
Yes.
They're not just a fund manager. So, for people who don't know Challenger, it's an annuity provider. So, they sell annuities for retirees, for institutions, essentially guaranteeing income for a certain period of time.
Sounds like a Ponzi scheme. Go ahead.
It's more like an insurance company than a Ponzi scheme.
Okay.
Very similar. But part of their business is obviously when you've got all that money, you manage it, similar to Berkshire Hathaway. And part of that is through they own a group called Fidante, which distributes, you're probably talking to some of their managers. I think it's groups like Bentham, Aries, a lot of fixed income and SIP fund managers, so involved in credit and fixed income
Did
sectors.
Did you say SIP?
CIP, yeah.
Is that the name of the fund or what is that?
I think it meant a Challenger Investment Partners. I think it's where it came from.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I think that was kind of their internal management.
Yep.
And they've got something like, or their group assets under management was $99 billion. It fell 10% for the year, but that includes both the statutory fund they have to hold for their annuities, and they call it life sales, as well as the assets under management of external investors. This is quite an interesting one because everyone talks about insurance companies being beneficiaries of higher interest rates, but they're actually impacted by higher interest rates. So, their profit, normalized profit, was up 19% to $472 million, but their statutory profit was down 57% to $254 million, and that was because they had to mark to market
their
book, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you're in insurance, majority of your assets are going to be fixed income, property,
yep,
lower risk, less volatile. And because bond yields were going up, the value of those fell. Even if you can deploy new money at a cheaper valuation, the assets that you already have. So that was something like $170 million hit from that portion. Which hit profit, and the share price went down 10% on the day. So, that was probably one of the biggest larger cap movers. I think it rallied 5 or 6% the day after. So, halfway to where it should be. But looking, I think it's very cyclical. So, looking beyond that, the company is obviously positive because life annuities sold up 14%. Sales to institutions, so like pension funds, which are now being forced to embrace this retirement income covenant, were up 68% for the year. And most importantly for investors, the dividend was up 15%. So, that tells you, you know, the normalized profit they're comfortable with, and the investment returns are kind of a, you know, mark to market or looking through those towards the profitability of the company.
Mm. I always thought Challenger could be a Ponzi scheme because I was like, how can they do something like guarantee a market return for so long when so many have gone before them and not been able to do that? I don't know.
It's like a bank where you just guarantee a market return that's quite low.
Yeah.
And that's probably the challenge they've had for the last 10 years is it's difficult to buy annuities when the yield you're guaranteeing is like 2.5%, 3.5%. You just naturally don't want to guarantee that for 10 or 15 years.
No.
But now that that's increased with interest rates and bond yields, it becomes very attractive once again.
Do you recommend annuities to your clients?
Not at the moment. But
just because of those, because they're so
low. Locking in at 2 to 3%, you didn't have any optionality. And if it was clear that rates were going to increase at some point in the next 10 years, it's difficult to do it at that time. But clearly it's changing now. And if your view is that interest rates are flat for an extended period of time, well, annuities become attractive for a portion of portfolios because guarantee a basic level of income is kind of what everyone wants.
So the just in terms of the segment report, so this is like the different business units, normalized profit, you could say, for the life business, that's the annuities business, was $472 million, as you said. And it's $83 million for the funds management business. Just to put it in context of how big they are, the life business is still the predominant business. But the funds management business is a natural growth driver for this company because they can distribute. They're already speaking to people. Just find great fund managers, put them in the platform, basically plug and go.
And they said one of the interesting ones was 98% of their assets under management, so the funds that they distribute or run, are outperforming their benchmarks over 3 years.
Interesting.
So everything's outperforming that they own. A lot of it isn't in equities. It's obviously in fixed income markets.
Yeah,
definitely. So that was super interesting. And heading in the right direction.
What benchmarks are you using? Look at me with my skeptical hat on.
Well, that's for the due diligence questions, but it's the same question you should ask, definitely. Yeah. Cash, probably cash.
Yeah, cash.
Cash plus.
Cash less inflation.
Interesting. I mean, the one unexpected thing was they bought a bank. I can't remember whether MyState Bank maybe it was
maybe,
2 years ago.
Makes sense.
And they just said they're looking at getting rid of it, essentially, you know, reversing out of Challenger Bank.
Because that's a very small part of their business.
Yeah, and it has capital requirements. And then I think they reported a net interest margin of 93 basis points. So it's hard to make money on a net interest margin of 93 basis points.
Bloody earth it is, yeah. So not worth the hassle when you've got two businesses that are already very good. Like the funds management business isn't market leading, but it's growing. That's very impressive. And then the life business is market leading. So why would you kind of distract yourself with something else?
The market seemed to think it was an F, but I kind of saw it as more of a C or a B.
It fell pretty much at the open, didn't it?
Fell 12%, but it's
it's come back a bit. Fell to a low of $6.07, and it's back up to $6.70
already.
Yeah, so if you're shrewd enough to make your entrance at that point, good on you. It keeps rolling on. It keeps building Challenger. So there you go. Really interesting one. Very popular for its dividend yield. I'd rather own like a diversified ETF to get my dividend yield, but I think it's a market leader in what it does. So yeah, let it roll on.
I think it's good getting diversification of income for when, like a lot of portfolios at the moment, we talk about BHP and the banks, getting diverse sources away from that, even if it's still in finance.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, good point. So I think we're left with one and one only, which I'll start with, seeing that I recommended this company and I have a lot of regrets about it, which is our Redbubble. So I'll summarize it. Not very good results. I think market was expecting weak results. The company had guided down anyway out of COVID, and they still probably... people were still probably caught off guard, hence the 31% share price fall, I think it was, on the day. So what does Redbubble do? Redbubble is an e-commerce website. You can go there and you can get designs of sometimes your favorite brands, or sometimes it could be things just like quirky little things that you get on your iPhone case or your favorite mug or, you know, travel mug or something like this, or a t-shirt. I think there's a new section on there called Pets, where you can get like a scarf for your dog. You can do all this sort of stuff. Who are its competitors? Its competitors are probably Etsy on one side, Etsy being the big US company. I actually looked at Etsy's results for the most recent quarter and the marketplace revenue was down. So I think that's worth highlighting, is that the biggest gorilla in the industry also reported some weaker results, and they also had to spend more for employment. That's Etsy. On the other side, there are other brands like indie brands and so on and so forth. So why do people use Redbubble? Well, artists go to Redbubble because they can upload their designs. And it basically means that they don't have to pack, fulfill, send, and redesign every design that they create. So if you have a design and it's like in a PNG file, like an image format, you can upload it to Redbubble and someone else can go along and use it on a mug or a pillowcase or whatever. And Redbubble will pay you if that design ever gets used. So that's as simple as it is. And that's why people like it. So in terms of marketplace revenue, for the full year, down 13%, gross profit down 18%. They spent 7% more on customer acquisition at, I think, $76 million. In terms of operating EBITDA, down 106%. So this is one of those ones that went from positive to negative. It went from positive $63 million to negative $3.6 million. EBIT, which is earnings before interest and tax, otherwise known as operating income, fell from $39 million to negative $22 million. So a huge reversal across the major metrics for the company.
Which I think they flagged a year or two ago as well.
Yeah. Because so during COVID, masks made up a healthy chunk of the sales. If you wanted a mask, but you didn't want to just wear the standard blue one, or you didn't want to wear the black one that your grandma had knitted for you, you could go to Redbubble and you could get one with, I don't know, maybe not Homer Simpson, but something funny on it, and you could get a mask like that. And so Kev, our old analyst, had one with the meme where there's like the little guy sitting in a burning down house, and he's like, "This is fine." That was his mask. That was, I really liked that. So, you know, this business is an interesting business in that it's trying to allow creators and designers to make money from their assets. It's a tough industry though, because on one hand, they need to be fed from Google and ads. And on the other hand, they've got fulfillment expenses.
Yeah.
So my original thesis for Redbubble was it's starting to get traction. People are growing awareness of it. You know, COVID was a good thing. I thought some of those artists and some of those consumers would hang around. Like once you try Redbubble, you get familiar with it, you like it, you keep going. And over time, the business would scale well. And then once it scales, basically what they call fulfillers, which are manufacturing sites that produce the t-shirts and produce this and ship it to customers and whatever, they would be able to go back to them and say, "Hey, we want more. We're the platform. You guys are commoditized. If you don't take our cost base for this t-shirt, we're just going to find the next manufacturing site that will take 20 million t-shirts over the next year and do it for less." And that basically hasn't happened. So Redbubble was a scale game, and all of a sudden it's turned around.
It was like our version of a NASDAQ stock, essentially. Yeah. It was seeking to get this kind of low margin business. You need to get scale, you need volume, and you need it quickly.
Yep.
And then when the market turns, the valuation you got, the cash you've got are all challenged.
Yeah.
I think the concept makes sense. The only thing, you look on the website and you probably think maybe too many verticals. Like, can you imagine having to deliver everything from homewares to t-shirts to masks?
Mm.
Maybe that's where they go next.
But you could get, if you're on a Redbubble right now, you could get a Rask branded.
You're on there.
I created a fake account, you know, like a dummy account. But I think you can actually order some. And it's horrible because I made it and everyone on the team was like, "Oh, don't show that." Maybe it's deleted now. I don't know. Maybe they
banned you.
Just got rid of it because like, this is ugly. But you could get a Rask branded shower curtain, and then you could go into the lounge room and get a Rask branded pillowcase. Take your phone with you. Well, there's a Rask branded phone case. So you could do that. But yeah, you're right. Like they have done a lot of verticals and the verticals have promised more. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's that. Personally, I think it's, are people using it?
Yeah.
And are artists saying, when they've got their Instagram profile or when they've got their website, are they saying, buy it on Redbubble? That's the network effect. Just like, you know, with Amazon Pay, Amazon Afterpay, it was like Pay in Full with Afterpay. Just having the logo on the website meant that everyone was like, "Oh, well, Afterpay, what's that thing? I'll go check that out."
Yeah.
I don't know if we've had that with Redbubble yet. I think the management team are great. Maybe I'm a bit smitten by them, but they're honestly, I think they speak really well internationally. I guess they're qualified for the role. So I think it's actually Seek Connection too with Michael, CEO. So I think it's a hard industry at the moment, particularly cycling off of COVID. Now I'm a bit hesitant in terms of trying to value the business. In the past, I found it I was a bit more comfortable. But with fulfiller expenses and inflation hitting supply chains, and on the other side, they're still spending acquisition to get acquisitions. I just find it a bit, it's
well, very cash burn becomes a problem, doesn't it? Yeah. They got $89 million in cash left. Yeah. Eventually, you have to raise capital. How dilutive does that capital raising become if you're still trying to, you know, pursue your strategic goals? I think listening to another podcast.
You listen to another podcast?
I do. I can't hear my own voice. I think one of the challenges you have is a lot of these tech companies that have fallen 60, 70, 80%, there's a risk that they get bought by someone who can leverage them and give them more scale. And that doesn't happen at the $7 that they hit 5 years ago, 3 years ago. It's more likely they're getting at a discount and around the current price. Not saying they'll be taken over, but it seems like what might happen for the quality businesses. And they do have a reasonably good model, it seems.
Yeah. So I just was checking via third-party websites, like checking things like website rankings and all that, and it's still, you know,
still up there,
intact.
I can buy you a sticker for $1.57.
Did you find it? $1.57? Yeah, probably not worth that, to be honest. If you did print it, let me know the quality. So the thing is, I think it's in a difficult spot, and when a company's in a position where there's the tailwinds have just become a dramatic headwind, management need to make some pretty hard choices typically. And typically the companies that do well, the companies that make the hard choices earlier on, at least that's what I've found. Like they make the decision, we've got to do this because things aren't as good as they were. And sometimes you need to change your strategy. I think, like I said, I think the management team's really good. The thing that they have with that cash balance, which I was looking at too, is that in the second half of the year, when we get the results like we did just now, the cash flow, still people haven't quite worked this out. But if you, in the lead up to Christmas is obviously the busy time. And because they're collecting the cash from the customers up front, kind of like Amazon, and then they're paying the fulfillers 30 days later or whatever it is, at December 31, their cash flow looks really good. And in the second half of the year, it looks like a dog's breakfast because then all of a sudden they've had to pay out all that cash.
Yeah.
And so that's what we tend to get, that shock and awe in the second half. And I think we just got dealt that blow.
I mean, it's covered by less analysts, if any. So that's probably where the struggle comes from too.
Yeah. I think the business has just got to be managed. I mean, I'm not telling them how to run their business. I don't know it as well as they do. But it's just now for investor expectations, it's just got to be managed to, yeah, we're going to survive and here's their plan. I think it's still a $400 million business and, I think it's still got really good assets. There are some things about it that are pretty tough, but, I really like management team. So we'll see. I'm looking forward to seeing how that one plays. I don't own shares in it, by the way, anymore. So, and we told our members to sell a little while ago, which I'm thankful for. So, mate, that's all of the companies. We've got Redbubble in reverse. We've got Car Sales. We've got Vicinity Senders. We did Seek, BHP, CSL. Did I miss any? Challenger. How could I forget Challenger? So some really good names there. If you do want to send us an email, I did get some messages through via Twitter. There is actually going to be a link in this week's show notes and it'll go to a type form. So that's just like a form that you can fill out anonymously. It asks you to send us your questions depending on which RAS podcast you listen to. You can get in touch with Drew, waddlepartners.com.au. Link will be in the show notes /contact. And you can find out more about Waddle Partners financial planning there. We're also, even though we talked about Seek and Drew owning Seek, we are also on LinkedIn. So if you do need to reach out, you can reach out that way. But if you do have a question, send it through the type form. We will ask you some questions as part of a survey as well while we do that, but it's completely anonymous. So go and check that out. We'll be coming back next week with more companies. Hopefully we'll have 10.
I think we'll.
Seven can was make a good sure number. I feel like seven's like a secret number in podcasts. It might be like you put seven in the title.
Like at fine dining, you always have an odd number rather than an even number.
Yeah. Maybe there's some science behind this. We're about to discover agile. That's what we are here at the podcast. So, Drew Meredith, Waddle Partners, thanks for joining me.
Thanks again.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that RASK could help you in 2024. As many of you know, RASK has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies. which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at Rask, which is the launch of our Rask Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high-growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high-growth strategy focuses on longer-term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside Rask Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios, as well as other members-only content. It's called Rask Core. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 Rask community members have begun the Rask plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni, and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if, you want to protect your family if something goes wrong, you want to protect your spouse if you lose your job, you want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy, insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that, but one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian Property Podcast by Rask, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of Rask Core, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this, this is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax. I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nevexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All RASC users get 20% off an annual plan with Nevexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nevexa's software and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nevexa, but they do create some great tools which the RASC community uses each and every day. Number 8, want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number 9, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the RASC YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the RASC network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that. All of that by going to the RASC Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we're on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. RASC Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the RASC Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000 and hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support RASC and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the RASC network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.